Today's guest is Sean Brock, who really needs no introduction, but here goes. Raised in rural Virginia, Sean has been instrumental in the rejuvenation of the Southern pantry and cuisine for the past 20 years. He's a James Beard Award-winning chef and restaurateur based in Nashville who owns and operates three restaurants, Joyland the Continental, which just opened last week, and Audrey, which will open later this year. His first cookbook, Heritage, is a New York Times bestseller and the winner of a James Beard Media Award. And in 2019, Brock released his second cookbook, South, which also became a New York Times bestseller. Thank you for joining us, Sean.
Thank you.
How was the opening last week?
I would say that, I probably opened around 15 restaurants.
Wow.
And it just doesn't get easier, but you would hope that it would get easier, but it sure doesn't. But this is most certainly the smoothest one I've ever experienced. So I'm very thankful for that.
That's amazing. Can you tell us a little bit about the concept?
So the Continental is a result of a lifetime of studying the food history of America. My studies have always been focused on the South, but as you're studying the South, you study America. And so I've kind of became infatuated with the fine dining of the Gilded Age and the creativity and spirit that was happening when people were inventing baked Alaska and oysters, Rockefeller, and lobster Newberg, and all those things. So it's a restaurant really inspired by that. Not recreating those dishes, but cooking in that spirit to hopefully create some new traditions. Lots of tableside cooking and carts, a lot of interaction with chefs, amazing playlists. We're trying to turn fine dining into fun dining.
Ugh, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds fabulous.
I feel like post-COVID, people are going to definitely be searching for more entertainment in their dining experience. That's amazing. And then Audrey, I know that's coming later this year. What's that going to be?
So I'm sitting in Audrey right now, and Audrey is a result of a lifetime of dreaming. So to see this dream come true is pretty surreal and has really caused a type of gratitude that I hadn't experienced other than having kids. Audrey is 10,000 square feet, has two restaurants, a bar, a research and development kitchen, a mindfulness center, a learning center, podcast studio. Yeah, so there's a casual restaurant downstairs, a tasting menu restaurant upstairs, a beautiful, beautiful bar.
Very excited. Can't wait to go down to Nashville for that one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to hear about the, you know, of course, I'm interested in the education, the learning center and the mindfulness center.
So the mindfulness center is basically a replica of the brain center at the rehab I went to in Arizona called The Meadows.
Right.
While I was there, they have this room they call the brain center where you go for neurofeedback and cranial electrotherapy stimulation, meditation, anything around regulating the nervous system. So I've recreated that room here, and you can book Reiki, acupuncture, intuitive massage. There's aromatherapy, sound therapy, these amazing sound bowls, cranial electrotherapy stimulation. The Meadows is going to come and do neurofeedback as an experiment, which is going to be really, really neat. It has its own sound system, soundproof. It has crazy plush 1970s shag carpet, which is really nice to walk on. And then it has lots of other devices that are designed to be able to quickly regulate your nervous system, things that vibrate at a specific hertz, or there's, you know, all kinds of different sound therapy in there as well that can quickly regulate the nervous system. We have to look at it a bit differently in the restaurant because we don't have a ton of time. So everything in there is designed to be pretty fast.
Is this for employees or is this also for guests of the restaurant?
Oh, it's for the employees. Yeah, I just spent the last hour in there, so I'm kind of relaxed right now.
Good.
Serving its purpose.
Yeah. The guests ask a lot, so maybe that's something down the road for sure. It's really kind of a perk for the employees, but it's also, you know, a small part of a big vision. When I went to rehab and was having so many health issues, all of the therapists there, every single one of them said point blank, you can't be in this industry anymore. Mm-hmm. You just can't be in this industry anymore. And so to hear that for the first time in my entire life, it's pretty terrifying because I don't know how to do anything else. And so I had a lot of time to think about that. The way I see it is, what if I create a place that actually reduces my stress and makes me healthier? Mm-hmm. And so that's how Audrey was born.
Just so our listeners know, you went to the Meadows for alcohol addiction?
Yes. So in January of 2017, I had just spent 2 years, almost 3 years, going undiagnosed with what I was later diagnosed with, an autoimmune disease, a neuromuscular one called myasthenia gravis. And that disease is nearly impossible to diagnose. It's called the snowflake disease. It's one of the most mysterious diseases. And what it does is the immune system attacks the junction that where the nerve meets the muscle. So it makes the communication very, very difficult, resulting in muscle weakness, fatigue, double vision. And so I passed every single test possible. I went to Vanderbilt University 74 times, I think, in 1 year, which if you think about that, that is really crazy.
Yeah.
And the tests were just crazy. There was one where they took this really long needle and stuck it up under my eye to monitor communication between the muscles and nerves without any painkillers or anything or any kind of numbing. They did the same one where they insert a needle pretty much the length of your forehead, and they do the same, and you have to lie there for 45 minutes. So it was a really, really, and I had really bad double vision. Every time I looked down, I would see double. So using a knife for cooking was just not smart. That resulted in a very, very, very dark period. Looking back, it was just a crash. You know, I was 39, and since I was 15, I've been working 12 to 15 hour days nonstop, and then hitting the bars after till 2 a.m. That just all added up and piled up and came crashing down. So on January 17th, my doorbell rang, and there were three people outside that didn't live in Nashville and weren't scheduled to visit my home that day. Mm-hmm. And I opened the door, and I knew exactly what was happening. It was just like the TV show Intervention. And gosh, there was a big part of me that was so relieved. Oh, just so, so, so relieved that I could finally get help with, you know, the alcohol, but also everything. I'd spent my entire life focused on work, and I hadn't done any work on myself. I didn't even know it was an option. I thought that I had to be Iron Man, and I had to be this very strong person who could never show weakness. But you see how that ended up.
You know, Sue and I have talked a lot about that belief that your worth is indicated by what you produce and how hard you work, and that that's the thing to challenge and learn from. And I'm curious how you've been able to challenge that and know that you're enough.
So while I was there, I became, I have a very obsessive personality. And I'm also like an investigator and a researcher, a collector, Enneagram type 5. So I became obsessed with psychology and the nervous system and the brain and the science behind it. I think I read around 40 books while I was there for 5 days. I was the nerd walking and reading. I literally caught myself walking and reading one day. I really needed to do that research to understand where to even start. When the thought of not being a chef entered my brain, of course, you start to worry about worth. Luckily, I discovered a psychologist named Alfred Adler, and his work has changed my life and helps and affects my life every single day. I use one of his theories to define worth, and his theories were so simple that he was dismissed for a big part of his life. But it turns out life really is that simple. For some reason, we're wired to want to make it more complicated for some strange reason. I'm definitely guilty of that. But his definition of worth is quite simple. It is contribution. And it is finding some place or something or anything, someone that you feel connected to, or that you feel like you belong to, or that you feel like you're a part of. And if you can work at contributing to that every day, that's the only worth you'll ever need as a human being. that sunk in for me. I started to then think about the importance of community and redefining community for myself. And he talks a lot about the different units of community. So he says the smallest unit is two people. For me, that would be Adi and myself. Moving out into larger units, the largest one being the universe, it allowed me to take almost like a chef perspective and a discipline to break down different units of community to then determine how far I could take it while remaining happy and healthy. So what I did was, if you think about the Wi-Fi symbol on your phone and those bands, the one at the very bottom or home plate, if it's a baseball field, is two people. So we draw those bands, and every restaurant has their own, and I encourage every employee to create their own. And so each band is a different unit of community. So for the restaurant, the smallest unit would be the two owners, myself and my investor. And then it goes to the next band or unit of community is high-level management. And then the next band or unit of community is the rest of the team. And then the next unit of community, the producers and the guests. And the next unit is our neighborhood. The next unit is our city. And then after our city, the industry. And so our rule is we have to have a full and deep understanding of our circle of competence, what we're able to achieve and what contributions we're able to make while remaining happy and healthy. And we refer to it as bandwidth because it kind of looks like bandwidth. The more you take on, the wider that bandwidth gets. And so when we're communicating and talking, you'll often hear, what's your bandwidth, or do you have the bandwidth to take on this? It's helped us have the discipline to take better care of ourselves first and foremost, so that we can then have the ability to take better care of others. Who knows what our limit may be, what our circle of competence is. But once we find it, then that's where we stay. And that's where happiness is, because we're pushing ourselves to contribute to as many communities that are important to us. But we're also able to contribute more because we're focused on fewer communities and are able to do it clear-headed. One of the things I learned and obsess over now is prefrontal cortex versus amygdala. And my life now has become this daily thing that I know I'm at my smartest and most intelligent when my nervous system is regulated and I have full access to my prefrontal cortex. What that looks like internally is understanding triggers. And so when you start at the restaurant, we discuss triggers and we give you the science of triggers and what a trigger is and how it works and dendrites and neural pathways. And then we create this culture of vulnerability that allows people to say, geez, I'm really triggered right now. Let's continue this conversation later. And that's, you know, that's immediately like, okay, absolutely. Or to apologize. You know, I was very triggered when I said that. That wasn't my heart and soul speaking. That was my fight or flight response. So it's created a layer of vulnerability that really, for me, has changed the dynamic of how a business can be ran, not just a restaurant.
Can you elaborate on the work around triggers and what you teach your staff about that?
So in our brain, you can kind of visualize this. We have two compartments where we store neural pathways, a wisdom filing cabinet and an unresolved trauma filing cabinet. And those neural pathways are formed when anything less than nurturing occurs in our lives, which is the definition of trauma at the Meadows. So if we don't resolve those, then they get stuck. And it's actually a physical thing that gets stuck. And those neural pathways, there's a cycle that has to be completed for that neural pathway to say, okay, my job is done. I've protected this person from dying. I can now sit it out on the wisdom side. But if we block that cycle from happening, which is physical, you feel it. It's a visceral response. If you block that because it's a scary feeling, or you mentally block it, then it gets stuck. And it haunts you for the rest of your life. Our first unresolved trauma neural pathway occurs at birth. And then we spend the rest of our lives collecting these neural pathways that just don't know any better. They're there to protect us. And what they're looking for is the opportunity to jump back in the game and protect you and then, you know, clock back out once the job is done. And they are triggered with our senses. So if you were, you had a mean teacher in the third grade that always wore a blue jacket, 15 years later, someone in a blue jacket could trigger that neural pathway. Now, what's fascinating when a neural pathway gets triggered is it kind of takes over and you respond, react, and behave the age at which that occurred. So when you're triggered, you don't have much access to your prefrontal cortex. You're responding, reacting sometimes like a child. So if you've ever been in an argument with someone and you find yourself thinking or saying that you are acting like a teenager right now, it's because they actually are. And to me, that is so fascinating. And those are the deep roots of vulnerability. If we understand that it's science and it's the way we're wired, then we're all the same. And it's okay to do dumb things. And it's okay to say dumb stuff. It's okay to make mistakes. But you have the responsibility and obligation to apologize, create a living amends, prove that you won't do that anymore, and learn and grow. And to me, that's wisdom.
Right. That experience of understanding where you went and that vulnerable child or young person within you, that they came out to have compassion for yourself and that, and then extend that compassion to others as well. You're absolutely right. It is wisdom and deeply healing. It actually does change your brain.
Yeah. You can rewire your brain. It's fascinating. It is absolutely fascinating. I fell in love with the work of this guy named Peter Levine, who since the late, probably mid-70s, has been studying unresolved trauma neural pathways. And he created a type of therapy called somatic experiencing, where he purposely triggers these neural pathways while you're in a REM type state. So you're able, it's almost like you're dreaming. You can get into that by EMDR and tapping and all kinds of different things. But he purposely triggers them so that he can guide you, or the therapist can guide you through the physical response that occurs, and to allow it to completely discharge and then reset the nervous system. And to me, I visualize that neural pathway either dissolving or moving over into the wisdom side. He's on the board at the Meadows and writes a lot of the curriculum. The Meadows, it wasn't a rehab like you see on TV. It was college. It was life university. I mean, there were seminars every day, classes, I mean, homework. It was incredible. It was absolutely, absolutely incredible. I wish everybody I knew could go, which is one reason why I'm bringing all these things into the restaurant. But I started doing SE work at the Meadows and continued until I ran out of bad memories. And that was a pretty, pretty amazing feeling.
Yeah. I've also worked with several people who received treatment at the Meadows, and it was completely transformative and so educational. And the neurofeedback piece seems to be the most powerful. And I can just completely see how for you to have this understanding of worth as a connection to contribution, and then to create Audrey and this space to give back to your team and the community, what a full circle moment that is for you. It makes so much sense that it does feel like a dream come true.
It's a reminder that there's always a gift hidden in the suffering. The best gifts are neatly wrapped in pain and suffering. And if you can have the patience to get through that suffering, knowing that wisdom is on the other end, then it's a little easier. I actually get excited about it in a twisted way, because I want to learn and grow as much as possible so that I can try to be a better person every day.
Yeah. I read something in one interview of yours, and you said that you've learned that failure is growth, which is such a poignant thing to say. Every time I hear someone express something like that, it feels profoundly wise. And I would love for you to elaborate on it, because I don't think we can hear enough of that perspective.
It started when I broke my first Hollandaise and got made fun of. This is pre-Google, of course. I immediately went home and pulled out Harold McGee's book, and I learned everything I could about what occurs when a hollandaise is made so that I would never get made fun of again. If I look back, as far as my career is concerned, that was one of those moments that has stuck with me, obviously. And so I try to get people excited and say, yay, celebrate failure. You made a mistake. That's awesome, because you're bound to make it at some point. Let's get it over with. Let's learn from it so that today we're 51% better than we were when we walked in the door. Also, failure should be celebrated because you're walking in the right direction, because you're trying something that could be challenging, or you're trying something that you almost know you're going to fail. That courage that comes along with it is so valuable. Alfred Adler talks a lot about the importance of courage. I truly believe that now. So what is my responsibility as the boss and the leader is to encourage. How do you encourage? Well, you show vulnerability, but also provide the tools. And so that's really my job every day that I really love. And I love challenging myself, trying to translate all of the things that I learned at the Meadows to the restaurant world. Pia Melody writes a lot of the curriculum at the Meadows, and she happens to be an expert on codependency. She wrote a book called Facing Codependence that is extraordinary, life-changing. The Meadows was 45 days, and codependency and the definition of it clicked for me on day 43. It's really hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people in the industry probably suffer from codependency. And yeah, I still have a difficult time understanding it, yet I think I understand how it shows up in my life. But yeah, but if you could define it and explain a little bit more, that'd be helpful.
So having grown up in the South and taking pride in being a Southern gentleman, you're trained to take the shirt off your back and give it to the person who needs it. That's one of the first things you learn. And the best way that I know to define codependency is unneeded suffering because you're worried about how it will affect someone else or what the outcome may be. That's the lack of courage. And why and how does the lack of courage exist? Because we don't have the tools and we're terrified of failure. So we miss out on a lot of opportunities. It's a lot of opportunities to actually help people, but also a lot of opportunities to be a better person. And so one of the things that Pia Melody focuses on is a communication model that she created that is honestly one of the most brilliant things I've ever read or practiced or tried to understand. It's built around conflict communication when someone is triggered or you've been triggered. It's four sentences. It's designed to avoid at all costs triggers. And so what we try to do is we use that model as much as possible when conflict is present. Because if I know that you've made me upset and I can communicate it to you without making you upset by triggering you, I'll have the courage to then get this off my back so I'm not carrying the resentment around. Resentment is heavy stuff. And especially in recovery, they call it the number one offender. The weight of resentment can really push you down into a dark, dark, dark place, into the swampland of the soul, as Carl Jung would say. And so this communication model is quite brilliant. The first sentence is referred to as the observable data or observable behavior or sensory data, things that you can pinpoint. And you start the conversation with that. First, you must start with asking if that person is in a place where they can receive some feedback. And if that person is triggered and is not ready, it doesn't matter what you say or how you say it. It's not going to register, and it's only going to cause more problems. Alfred Adler talks a lot about the importance of a horizontal relationship and no one ever feeling less than or better than. Pia Melody also talks about that a lot. They would refer to it as one up position or one down position. And when you're communicating, you keep that in mind. Is anything I'm doing physically or saying going to make that person feel less than and put me as the higher power, which would then cause them to react in a way to flip the seesaw the other direction? So they're not even listening to anything you have to say. So the first sentence has to be a very specific incident. I, for the longest time, suffered from using so many broad stroke statements. you always or every time, you've already lost that person because they're scanning their brain for all of the times that they could have possibly made a mistake. So you focus in on that one. The second sentence is, so an example would be, yesterday in the meeting when I saw you reading your emails while I was speaking. Second sentence is the emotion generated by that. The Meadows, they choose to refer to the 8 basic emotions. You then take those 8 basic emotions and there's sub-emotions that make it a little easier to communicate because there is a thing about trying to avoid triggering words. And then the third sentence, the most important, is where you can't use the word you. That's where we mess up. That's where we point the finger. That person's going to feel defensive immediately. So you say that third sentence from the I perspective. And you explain why you think you felt that way when you saw that. When I saw you reading an email during today's meeting while I was speaking, made me very frustrated because it made me think what I was saying wasn't important. So that's vulnerability. You're sharing from your perspective and there's no right or wrong. And then the fourth sentence is the setting of a boundary and therefore the consequence that would occur crossing that boundary. You started by saying, in the future, I'd prefer that you didn't read your email. And if that boundary is crossed, blank will occur. So it becomes very clear the boundary and the consequences. In recovery, they call it the gift of consequences. You don't rob a bank because you'll probably go to jail. You know the consequence of that. And then the listener has a set of rules. And mindful listening is also an art form. The listener asks themselves 3 questions. Is that true to my reality? Is that false to my reality? Or do I need to ask for more information? It has caused me to just really focus on efficiency in communication in general and just life in general. The more we say, the more we stutter, the more we let fall out of our mouths, the more opportunities for a trigger is going to happen. What are we trying to do? We're trying to express this one thing. We don't need 1,000 words.
Right. And slow down, right? Slow down and say exactly what you mean as accurately as you can. And notice how you're saying it and be aware of that and notice how the person's receiving it as well. And I think that's the very, very first step of asking, are you open to receiving this right now? Is one that none of us, I won't use extreme language. We don't tend to practice that. It does not come naturally.
Especially when you're triggered.
Right. The difference between someone receiving a you did this and you really upset me message versus a when this happened, I felt this way and I was really upset by it is night and day.
Yeah. See, how are you going to argue with that? There's no argument.
Right.
You can't tell the person how they should feel. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. I love this stuff. Actually, one of the first times I went down to Nashville to meet with you to talk about collaborating, you know, you were telling me about all of this. And this was a couple of years ago. And it was definitely the first time where I started thinking about these things, you know, and thanks to you, I kind of then started a journey on kind of understanding my codependency issues. I'm curious, like, if we go back to your childhood, your upbringing, what do you think potentially happened or experiences throughout your life that kind of made you the person that you are, made you gravitate towards serving others? You mentioned, you know, being a Southern gentleman, it's always about giving to others first and taking care of others first. Yeah, I would just love to hear from you. How do you think you found your way into the kitchen? How do you think you found your way into a career based on giving to others?
So when you show up at the Meadows, your first assignment is to number a piece of paper, a large piece of paper, from 0 to 18 or 0 to 17. And then you write down every bad memory possible and try and guess what age it was. And then you spend the next 44 days working on all those things. When I was 11, I lost my father. Of course, that's going to affect the trajectory of your life. But it's really how each individual responds to it and which responsibilities they trick themselves into believing is theirs. So me being 11 at the time, I thought I had to take the father of the household role. Now that's still my role. Like I've always just wanted to be the person responsible for others, for their success and for their well-being. Once I started really digging deep into the whys, you understand the importance of the inner child work, certainly. But what really made me take a step back was when the therapist said, who told you you had to be the person to take charge of the family? I said, me. And she said, well, tell yourself otherwise. Tell yourself the opposite and be done with it. And just that theory, that's how you steer around, navigate codependency. You ask who told you that. And most of the time it's yourself. And if you just reframe it, you can oftentimes navigate around a lot of issues. But I started seeking a community to be a part of. I was a long-haired skateboarder. I wasn't ever in sports or in high school or anything. So once I found the kitchen at the age of 15, I knew right away that like I belonged to that community because I grew up around food, being a Southerner with a grandmother has, you know, the garden in the basement full of mason jars. And so I'd been cooking since I was, you know, 10, 11 years old, like cooking actual meals. And so it was a perfect fit for me. And I went to culinary school as soon as I got out of high school.
That's great. I love that. What are your observations and insights on the kitchen culture? How it was when you were coming up the ranks versus what's happening now? Because, you know, I think the last couple of years has shed a lot of light on the toxic environments that a lot of these kitchens have been brewing.
Well, learned behavior is fascinating. You know, I came up in toxic, abusive environments. So when I had my first chef job, I created a toxic, abusive environment because I didn't know any better. And I was seeing the immediate results of that intensity until someone stops you and says, dude, that's screwed up. You can't act that way towards other human beings. You just keep doing it. And so what's happening now is people are speaking up and people are understanding that you don't have to lead that way and you don't have to work for someone who leads that way. So it's causing this shift in people's behavior. And it's a big moment. It's a big, big, big moment. Not that we've changed things overnight. It's that we're walking in the direction of progress and that we're sitting here having this conversation right now. And it's on people's minds and people are starting to put it into action. It'll take time. You know, it'll be a highlight of our generation.
Was there a moment when someone gave you that direct feedback and said, hey, you can't treat people this way? You can't treat me this way?
Well, that's what's interesting is you create a culture of fear and people are scared to even say that, and which is just, you know, awful to think of. And I certainly had to really work through a lot of shame and guilt around the way I operated kitchens for a long time. But yeah, I mean, I can trigger that neural pathway and be in that moment when someone said that to me, because it was so shocking. We get so used to these awful environments and standards that we set for ourselves and others set for us that we get lost. And it just becomes a cycle. And you keep re-traumatizing yourself over and over and over again. And those dendrites just keep forming. And it's just a mess until you say, I'm going to push the reset button. And the beauty of being human is understanding that the past does not exist and the future does not exist. What we have is right now. And I can push the reset button this very moment and say to myself, I will change my behavior from this moment forward at this time on this day, and then focus on the living amends of I will prove that every day, that through my changed behavior, I'm trying to be a better person.
Yeah. Can you elaborate on the things that you've learned about shame and guilt? Because I feel like my own shame and guilt results in nasty behavior, right? Whether it's me overcompensating for, or I don't know, trying to understand it better for myself and yet not quite understanding it. It results in oftentimes, you know, the bad behavior that I do have in my life.
Perpetuating the cycle.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
In my opinion, shame and guilt of the 8 basic emotions are the 2 most dangerous. Carl Jung, I mentioned it earlier, he calls shame the swampland of the soul. And if you picture that, that's, you know, that's a deep, dark, nasty, awful place that we should try to avoid at all costs. And shame and guilt exist for a reason and they exist for a purpose. And that's to alert us to something that needs to be fixed. And what I've been taught is recognize the shame or guilt, recognize the role they played, and then say, thank you. You can go away now. I get it. Appreciate the help, but you don't have to stick around. And that's the art of letting go.
They sort of look different in how you approach them, because shame is an emotion that makes us want to hide and not be seen. And so a great way to approach it, once you've seen it yourself and said, you know, thank you for being here, it also can help to share with someone the shame that you're, a safe person, the shame that you're feeling, to not hide, to, you know, be understood, to be accepted. With guilt, it is a little different. It's less about the hiding and more about acknowledging, the, like you said, the living amends, acknowledging the harm caused and making a repair. And then for both, and then keep it moving.
It's not about the rip, it's about the repair. I remind myself that all the time, because geez, if we wallow in shame and guilt at every mistake we make, we're just going to be unhappy. And when we're unhappy, we can't connect with others. And when we can't connect with others, we can't contribute. And when we can't contribute, we don't feel worth. And when we don't feel worth, guess what? You're right back in the shame and guilt cycle. And it goes around and around and around.
What tools can you tell our listeners that you use to have a more fulfilling life and how to be a better leader? You talked about conflict resolution earlier and understanding the gift of consequences and taking care of yourself and being vulnerable and letting go. But what do you do on a daily basis to practice a more fulfilling life?
So one thing that recovery has taught me, and I also noticed at the Meadows, was the importance of doing a daily inventory, an inventory of fear. For myself, a fear inventory or concern inventory. Fear is a scary word for a lot of people. A concern inventory and a resentment inventory and a gratitude inventory. If I can put three out, try to create these lists of 15, 20, 30 things, I'll do three a day. That's my goal, and that's what I work on as I'm going to sleep. And when I wake up, I'm getting ready to start the day. I'm going through those inventories, and I'm working on walking in the right direction to try and improve those things, tackle those things, address those things, and then realize that's really all I can do. I refer to it as the 51% theory. If I can go to bed and know that I did 51% better than the day before, good.
So three concerns or fears, three resentments, and three things you're grateful for.
Great. And what is the hope that you have for Audrey and the educational center that you're building, and how that helps not only your employees, but the industry at large?
I wanted to have those resources available to my team. There's a huge smart screen in here that we use to have guest speakers come in and speak about empathy, speak about conflict communication, and speak about self-compassion, experts on those things, Imago dialect. It's a place where I just want us to have an opportunity to continue our education and be curious for us internally, that band of our community. But the next band out is our neighborhood. And so the nonprofit that we have here at the restaurant, where we make 2,000 meals a week for the neighborhood, also we'll have a curriculum for a mentorship program to teach kids in the neighborhood everything they need to know, from getting a job to stocks and sauces and any knowledge that we've been privileged enough to receive to pass on and create like a mini school almost, so that hopefully they'll work here.
So cool. I mean, it just makes so much sense, you know, to be feeding people and providing nutrients and nutrition, not just on a physiological level, but also on an emotional and psychological level. It's really the way we would all benefit from thinking about life from this whole body and mind perspective. And I'm just so grateful that you're doing this work.
Oh, thank you. I've realized that it's all I need. That's all I'll ever need. And I'm good. And I can just carefully and patiently do this work and know that that's it.
Well, thank you, Sean, so much. That was really inspiring.
Oh, thank you.
Made me really think about, you know, thinking globally, but acting locally in its truest sense. And, you know, first caring about yourself, then caring about your loved ones, and then your community. Yeah, I think that's super inspiring, because it's so easy to get caught up in, what is my legacy? And, you know, what, how am I going to go down the history books? But I think you get, like you're illustrating and saying and living, you just will find so much more happiness and fulfillment by just focusing on what's closest to you.
I will say with extreme confidence that I'm the happiest person I know.
Well, thank you so much, Sean. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.